What's up, everybody? This is DJ Liberty here on my show, Political Row. Hope everybody's having a great Monday. Now, we got a lot of news for you here today. Some great political news going on. So, we'll start it off, of course, with our international segment, and then we will move on from international to national political news, and from there, we will take it into some California state news. So let's kick it off. On March 30th, senior U.S. lawmakers on Sunday said investigators had found no evidence thus far pointing out to terrorism in the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 3 weeks ago, and that it was critical to find the plane to understand what happened on board. Now, the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers and Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Dianne Feinstein spoke on Sunday talk shows and said that they had seen no evidence of foul play. U.S. officials closed to the investigation last week, saying that the FBI examined data and it received from a homemade flight simulator and other computer equipment used by MH370's pilots, but found nothing illuminating. Now, more than two dozen countries and 60 aircraft and ships continued to search for the missing Boeing Co-777 airliner on Sunday, days before the batteries in the locators attached to its black boxes are set to die. Alan Dial, who has 40 years of experience investigating accidents for the U.S. government and military, urged President Barack Obama to offer Malaysia the use of large numbers of U.S. P-3 Orions, Air Force MC-130 Special Forces transports, and U.S. submarines to hunt for the wreckage before the pingers die. He told Reuters such efforts would be costly, but were needed for the victims' families to deal with possible safety issues with the 1,100 777s now flying and to avert a negative impact on future sales of Boeing's newest 777 model, the 777X. Feinstein told CNN the Malaysian government was in charge of the search effort and it would have to ask for additional search or intelligence resources from the U.S. government. Now, the Malaysian government has said it believes the plane's course was deliberately altered, but it remains unclear by whom or whether the change was made in response to a technical fault. The Boeing 777 has one of the best safety records of any commercial aircraft in service. Now, that's crazy how this best safety records aircraft can go missing and just not be found, period. That it's just unreal. I mean, we've visited this topic so much here on my show. I think this is here the third week that we're talking about it. This plane has been missing for 3 weeks. That is crazy. I feel like everything needs to be put into effect to find this plane. The families of those loved ones that were on that plane that are wherever they are need to be found. The plane needs to be found. It needs to be figured out as to what actually happened with this aircraft. Feinstein echoed that the State of the Union program had not seen any evidence indicating a terrorist attack brought the airplane down. She was asked if she had seen higher resolution satellite images of the possible debris spotted in the Indian Ocean than those made public, and Feinstein said she had not, and suspected intelligence officials did not have any additional data to offer the Malaysians. She said the lack of sharpness in the images made public could be linked to the sophistication of the satellite that gathered the imagery, but declined to provide further details. So at this point, it still looks like no government, unless they're keeping it from us, has any idea of what happened to this aircraft. I mean, who knows? It could have been something terroristic and none of the governments want to show it or let it get out, but we'll never know. And I guess we just got to wait and see if we ever find that plane or if it ever becomes public. So now to move on, of course, as I have talked here on Political Row a lot about Ukraine and Russia and the entire world and the effect that everything that's gone on in Ukraine, it's brought up here again, and it's going to be the majority of this international segment. The Senate and the House pass Ukraine aid and Russian sanction bills. Congress spoke with one voice against Russia's annexation of Crimea, passing legislation in the House and Senate giving help to crash-strapped Ukraine and imposing sanctions against Russia. Now, the Senate approved the legislation by voice vote Thursday at the same time the House was passing a different version on a 399-19 vote. The votes were a show of solidarity with President Barack Obama, who had already announced sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin and many others. The president spent several days rallying U.S. allies to stand firm against Putin's aggression. Lawmakers intended to get a final measure to the White House by day's end. Each bill would provide $1 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine and impose penalties on Russia for its aggression. President Putin is watching, waiting to see if we have to resolve, if we have the resolve to act, said Senator Bob Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, and also the chairman of Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Menendez said the Senate bill would provide this $1 million loan guarantee to help stabilize Ukraine's economy and would authorize assistance for democracy, governance, and civil society programs and enhance security cooperation. It also would provide support for the Ukrainian government to help recover assets linked to corruption by former Ukraine government officials. The measure would also sanction those who are responsible for human rights abuses against anti-government protesters and those responsible for undermining the peace and sovereignty of the Ukraine. Targeting Russia, the bill also would freeze assets and revoke visas of Russian officials and their associates who are complicit in or responsible for significant corruption in Ukraine. The Senate bill authorizes $50 million in assistance to Ukraine for such things as improving democratic governance and anti-corruption efforts, supporting free and fair elections in Ukraine, and bolstering democratic institutions and civil society organizations. The bill passed here by the Senate is crucial to see that the House is backing up what President Obama wants to do here with Russia. It's crucial for the United States to see that we're making a move as a whole, not just President Barack Obama going out and putting sanctions on Russian officials, freezing their visas, and now we are supplying aid to Ukraine to kind of put a halt to what Russia is doing. Russia needs to understand that this is not the right thing to do, and it's, I mean, this is so far-fetched and coming from people who aren't really educated on something like this, but it's just going around here with some of the people that I know that, like, Putin is looking to just start a war. He's looking for a World War III, and it's so scary to even throw those words out there. I'm not even sure how I feel about that, but if things keep escalating the way they do and Putin can't get a grasp of how serious these matters are, I mean, who knows where it could end up. And speaking of which, Putin has sought diplomatic leverage with troop buildup, and intel experts say that this is no shy strategy to scare off and build up the aggression of Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin has bolstered his troops on the eastern border of Ukraine, not in the hopes of taking over more of the country, but to bolster his hand in diplomatic talks. Putin called President Obama on Friday to discuss the U.S. push for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Ukraine. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are scheduled to meet in Paris Sunday for further discussions. In an interview with CBS News, Scott Pelley, Mr. Obama said that Putin has been willing to show a deeply held grievance about what he considers to be the loss of the Soviet Union, suggesting Russian nationalism and a desire to reverse the impression that the West has taken advantage of Russia are at play. Now, Putin is basically taking a step out of the line here and saying that what he is doing now is making Russia be known again around the world as a superpower. It needs to get out there that the U.S. is not in control of the world, and that's what Putin wants to portray. It's not what I agree with, but it's what Putin wants to do. Now, former National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden said that it was also likely Putin is looking for ways to ensure Russia is able to keep Crimea, even though several other world leaders have said that they do not accept the region's secession from Ukraine and subsequent annexation by Russia to be legal. The two intelligence officials for Mr. Obama's reforms to the NSA queries data will make Americans both safer and less concerned about government infringement on their privacy. The president announced Wednesday that the workable proposal from the intelligence community is to have phone companies, rather than the government, hold onto bulk data that is collected and to reform judicial oversight of the way the agency queries the data. House lawmakers are crafting a bill that would follow the same basic principles to reform the system. This all ties into the sanctions and controlling what is going on here with Russia in Crimea. Because Putin obviously wants to put it out there that Russia is nobody to mess with, and they do have control of situations. They do have an army that should be feared, and they do have the ability to literally walk over a border and take control, to break the law of international laws and to do whatever it wants to get what they want. And Vladimir Putin is making this very clear by obviously stepping into Ukraine, bringing troops, building up the troop numbers up to 40 or 50,000 more coming in this week, and making a statement that Russia is not to be messed with. Now, Putin has reached out to Obama as the Russian troops continue to mass on the Ukraine border. And as Russian forces continue to mass on the Ukrainian border, Russian President Vladimir Putin put in a call to President Obama late Friday evening, when Obama was visiting a White House official, that tells CBS News when this all occurred. They spoke for an hour with translators, and Obama was at his Riyadh hotel room during the conversation. The official emphasizes they did not discuss any new proposal on Ukraine. The conversation centered on what was previously referred to as the off-ramp, the call for Russia to allow international observers and open direct talks with the Ukrainian government. The White House later issued a statement on the conversation. President Obama underscored to President Putin that the United States continues to support a diplomatic path in close consultation with the government of Ukraine and in support of the Ukrainian people with the aim of de-escalation of the crisis. President Obama made clear that this remains possible only if Russia pulls back its troops and does not take any steps to further violate Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty. President Obama reiterated that the United States has strongly opposed the actions that Russia has already taken to violate Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. I think this is a great statement put out by the White House. It obviously shows where the White House, where the Obama administration stands with this entire thing. Now, whether you approve of it or not, it's good that the entire administration is in agreement of what they want to do here. And just as I said, the Senate, the House, Congress, they are all supporting what's going on here by passing a Ukrainian aid bill. However, Vladimir Putin does not understand what's going on here, and it really needs to be displayed in some way to him that this is not what needs to be done. He can't keep doing this. The last thing we want is military interference and another war, battle, something. We want peaceful resolution. That's what the U.S. has been striving for. However, I honestly don't know how this is going to happen unless Putin is able to talk with us and understand where we are coming from and what he's doing is completely wrong. And now Putin says he's pulling some of his troops back from the Ukrainian border, but I don't exactly think this is the full story of what Putin is doing. Now, potentially easing a diplomatic standoff with the West, Russian President Vladimir Putin told Germany Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday that he'd ordered a partial withdrawal of Russian troops from his country's border area with Ukraine. Putin made the comment to Merkel in a phone call about Ukraine, her office said. The Kremlin made no mention of a withdrawal in its description of the call, but said the two leaders discussed Ukraine, including possibilities for international assistance to restore stability. Further details about Putin's reported order weren't immediately available, but a withdrawal may ease tensions simmering since Russia annexed Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea this month, a move that has led to the worst East-West relations since the Cold War. Now, that's scary to hear that this is the worst the East-West relations have been since the Cold War, being that the Cold War was a scary time period for the East and the West going back and forth. And the fact that the relations are worse than that was is frightening to hear because, I mean, what if this does turn into a Cold War II or a World War III or just some new war that can't be handled by the U.S., by the world? It's just, this is nothing to have a war over. Earlier Monday, Russian media reported that one Russian infantry battalion was being moved from the border area to its base deeper into Russia. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said that if reports about Russia removing troops from the border were accurate, it would be a welcome preliminary step. The news about Russian troops came on the day that Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev traveled to Crimea, the highest level visit from Moscow since Russia annexed the region, in part to unveil measures aimed at integrating the peninsula into the Russian economy. Ukrainian and Western officials for weeks have voiced alarm about Russia's reported military buildup on Ukraine's eastern border, which has raised fears that Russian troops would enter the Ukrainian mainland and that Russia may have 40,000 troops near its border with eastern Ukraine and another 25,000 inland on alert and prepared to go in. These numbers of troops are insane. 40,000 troops near its border, 25,000 inland on alert, ready to act. It's crazy how many troops Putin has put into this Ukrainian movement to try and take the peninsula of Ukraine and make it part of the Russian economy. I think something needs to be done. I think Putin needs to be put in his place. And I don't know how it needs to happen, but it needs to happen quickly before a war starts. And I mean, who knows, a war can happen from Putin being disciplined for this. Although we do want to strive for a peaceful resolution. On that note, we are going to take a quick short break here. We will return with a couple more segments or a couple more stories for the international segment, and then we will move on to our national stories. So stay tuned here for this quick short break on radio.dominican.edu, and you're listening to me, DJ Liberty, on my show, Political Row. What's up, everybody? We're back here on Political Row on Penguin Radio. Now, we just left off talking about Ukraine and Russia. And now I want to touch on the Americans' negative attitude toward Obama and his responses and reactions to Ukraine and his actions, just straight how he's handling the situation. Now, as the Obama administration responds to Russia's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine, the latest CBS News polls show more Americans disapprove, which is 46%, than approve, which is 38%, of the way President Obama is handling the situation between the two countries. But when looking more closely at the public's views on the Crimean situation, the negative attitude toward the president's handling of the situation raises a lot of questions. 56% of Americans approve of the sanctions enacted against Russia by the U.S. and other European countries. The first concrete action the Obama administration has taken in response to the annexation. nor does it seem most Americans think the Obama administration should take some time other than more aggressive steps. 65% of Americans who do not think the U.S. should approve military aid and weapons to Ukraine. What's more, majorities of Americans think the situation in Crimea is both beyond the control of the U.S., which is 57%, and that the U.S. does not have responsibility to do something about it, which is 61%. What then do Americans disapprove of, and why? Although Americans tend to pay less attention and have less knowledge of events overseas than domestic concerns, lack of knowledge does not seem to be the main factor. 69% of the Americans have heard or read at least something about the situation between Russia and Ukraine, including more than a third who say they have heard or read a lot, which is 36%. More importantly, those who have heard or read a lot about the situation are more likely, which is 56%, to disapprove of the president's handling of the situation than Americans overall, which is 46%. Now, not surprisingly, the partisanship probably plays a role, and there's a clear break along party lines when it comes to how the president is handling the situation between Russia and Ukraine. 59% of Democrats approve of Mr. Obama's handling of the situation, while 69% of the Republicans disapprove. But more independents also disapprove, which is 48%, than approve, which is only 35% of the president's handling of the situation between Russia and Ukraine. So party identification is not the only factor. Disapproval of the president's handling of the situation between Russia and Ukraine may also be a reflection of disapproval of his overall job performance. In the same poll, 50% of Americans said they disapprove of the job Barack Obama is doing as president, while just 43% approve. Now, Americans have held a net negative rating of Mr. Obama's job performance since September of last year, and they similarly express a net negative view of his handling of the economy, healthcare, immigration, Afghanistan, and foreign policy in general. So, this raises the question, is the majority disapproving of what Obama is doing because they disapprove of Obama, period? Or is it because it's actually disapproving of what Obama is doing? This raises so many questions, just as I said, of really how Americans feel about this situation alone, rather than just Obama and his administration. Personally, I don't know what more we could do to handle this situation, which then raises the question, do we even belong in this enactment, and how do we act if we don't interact with the other nations and countries that are trying to stop Russia? However, on another note, as I said earlier, John Kerry meets with Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, and on Sunday, Russia set out demands for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Ukraine, saying the former Soviet republic should be unified in a federation allowing wide autonomy to its various regions, as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov met in Paris in another bid to calm tensions. After a brief call on French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, Kerry sat down with Lavrov at the residence of the Russian ambassador to France to go over Moscow's response to a U.S. plan to de-escalate the situation as Russian troops continue to mass along the Ukrainian border. The men said nothing of substance as they shook hands, although after Kerry ended the photo op by thanking assembled journalists, Lavrov cryptically added in English, "Good luck and good night." Now, appearing on Russian television ahead of his talks with Kerry, Lavrov rejected suspicions that the deployment of tens of thousands of Russian troops near Ukraine is a sign Moscow plans to invade the country following its annexation of the strategic Crimean Peninsula. Russia says the troops near the border are there for military exercises and that they have no plans to invade, but U.S. and European officials say the numbers and locations of the troops suggest something more than just exercises. And despite the Russian assurances, U.S., European, and Ukrainian officials are deeply concerned about the buildup, which they fear could be a prelude to an invasion or intimidation to compel Kiev to accept Moscow's demands. This is all really frightening to see that Russia is pursuing what they want to do. They have no regret in putting troops out there, and they could even be lying about it, saying they're doing exercises when they're throwing out 40 to 50,000 troops near the Ukrainian border and saying they're just doing exercises. Come on now. I mean, that is such a silly excuse, and to think that anybody in the world should understand or believe that they're saying this is just a military exercise should not feel, I mean, it should feel stupid. I mean, come on now. This is not an exercise. They're going to invade Ukraine, and they're going to try and take over Ukraine with invasion and intimidation and make it Russia's land, make it part of Russia's economy. Now, Obama has sought reassurance of Saudi King Abdullah on Iran and Syria. Now, stemming away from Ukraine and Russia, Obama now has other plans. While he paid a visit Friday to the desert oasis of Wari, ally King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, hoping to reassure the aging monarch who is nervously watching Washington's negotiations with Iran and other U.S. policy in the Middle East. Obama's Marine One helicopter kicked up clouds of sand in his arrival at the King's Desert Camp outside the capital of Riyadh for a meeting and dinner with Abdullah. The president walked through a row of military guards to an ornate room featuring a massive crystal chandelier and took a seat next to the 89-year-old king, who was breathing with the help of an oxygen tank. Secretary of State John Kerry sat at Obama's side for the visit that is the president's third official meeting with the king in 6 years. Despite its decades-long alliance with the United States, Saudi's royal family has become increasingly anxious in recent years over Obama's nuclear talks with Iran and his tepid involvement in the Syrian civil war. During his evening meetings with the king, Obama's task was to reassure Saudi Arabia that the U.S. is not abandoning Arab interests despite troop withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan, greater energy and independence back home, and nuclear talks with predominantly Persian Iran. White House officials and Mideast experts say the Saudi royal family's main concern is Iran. They fear Iran's nuclear program, object to Iran's backing of the Bashar Assad regime in Syria, and see the government of Tehran as having designs on oil fields in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. On Syria, Rhodes said Obama did not plan to make any specific announcements about additional assistance to oppositional forces. He said the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have been working together closely to coordinate their assistance to the rebels. Rhodes said that the coordination has helped put the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia in a stronger place today than it was in the fall when we had some tactical differences about our Syria policy. Now that's going to conclude our news for our international political news. We're going to take another real quick short break here on radio.dominican.edu, and you're with DJ Liberty here on Political Row. What's up, everybody? We're back here on Political Row with me, DJ Liberty, on Penguin Radio. Now, we are going to continue here with some national political news. So, let's get it started. As the deadline arrives for Obamacare, Americans are still disapproving. Now, 4 years has been put into this Obamacare with the Affordable Care Act, and the deadline to sign up for health exchanges is here, and however, a majority of Americans continue to oppose the law, as 53% disapprove, while 41% approve, according to the latest CBS News poll. Since the law was passed, the Affordable Care Act, in March 2010, more have consistently disapproved than approved of it. Public support has never reached the 50% mark. That's a huge tank for what this Affordable Care Act wants to accomplish. They can't even get to 50% on this. That's not even close to anywhere near majority. It's not even half. So that is a huge blow to the Affordable Care Act, which then directly affects the support for Obamacare. In an attempt to enroll healthier people into the health our exchanges, the Obama administration has been targeting young adults to sign up, but they don't think much of the law. Despite young Americans' overall support for President Obama, as 48% approve of the job the president is doing, the highest of any age group, 60% says he's a strong leader, and a slim majority even approve of his handling of health care as an issue. They are not enthusiastic about the Affordable Care Act, as 42% approve of it, but more around 50% disapprove. Whereas opinions were similar in January, young Americans' views on the health care law do not differ much from those who are older. Like Americans overall, many young people support many elements of the Affordable Care Act, but are strongly opposed to the individual mandate requiring nearly all Americans to get health care coverage. 66% disapprove of it, according to a December CBS News New York Times poll. Cost is a concern. That same poll also found that while a majority, 53% of Americans under the age of 30 thinks getting health insurance may improve the quality of their life, 3 in 4, about 75 to 76%, say getting that coverage will hurt them financially. After the much-publicized troubled rollout of healthcare.gov, young people hold negative perceptions of how the sign-up on the exchanges is going. Just 26% think the process is going well in the recent CBS News poll, while 39% don't think it is. Now you can see if young people can't agree with the Affordable Care Act and they can't agree with Obamacare, how can anybody? Obama appeals so much to the young adults in the United States, and if he can't even gain respect for the Affordable Care Act and his Obamacare, while they also just support him as the president, how can he expect to get this Obamacare bill action through and have support for it? It's such a stretch to get a huge support for it when they can't even get 50% to agree or approve of the Affordable Care Act and thus far Obamacare. Now, the clock is winding down and Obamacare has just become a huge political fight. Today is March 31st and the date has finally arrived, and with it is the last official day for people to sign up for the health insurance on the federal exchange websites. The deadline, of course, isn't a hard one. The administration announced last week that people who started to apply for health insurance by the deadline but didn't finish the process will still be able to get coverage. And just as enrollment doesn't close for good on Monday, the fight over Obamacare will hardly be settled by the coming and going of the end of the month. Opposing the health care law is still the status quo among Republicans, and there are no signs they'll stop trying to hang this issue around Democrats' necks during the upcoming midterm elections. The administration said last week that more than 6 million people had signed up for coverage through the new insurance marketplace, though it estimated that fewer than that have actually paid their first premiums. Even with that small victory hitting a revised goal for enrollment, Republicans aren't ready to give an inch of ground to suggest the law has worked. On Fox News Sunday, Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, said on Fox News Sunday that the administration is cooking the books on the enrollment numbers, which were meaningless. And he's actually not alone. The Republican National Committee stands ready to poke holes in any measure of success the administration might claim, warning that it hasn't attracted sufficient numbers of uninsured Americans or young people, that the enrollment figures don't represent people who have paid for their new plans, and charging that the administration has not been forthcoming about the penalty of $95 or 1% of income that people who don't sign up for the insurance will have to pay. Democrats are attempting to focus their midterm election message on ways to improve income inequality, but the passage of Obamacare enrollment deadline may only offer a brief respite from the storm. In less than 2 months, insurers must submit their 2015 rate proposals to government regulators, which could lead to a fresh firestorm of criticism if those increases are too high. One company, WellPoint Inc., said it might see increases of double digits in its plans earlier this month. Now, that's not much more than the less significant increases Health and Humanity Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said might occur when she testified on Capitol Hill this month. Now, to be honest, I do not know a lot about Obamacare. I don't know the in-depths of enrolling for Obamacare. I don't know all of the proceedings that it takes, but seeing this and seeing how the support just around the nation is not approving what Obamacare is striving to do, what Obamacare provides, how much it costs, it poses the question, is it worth it? Is it going to work? Are the Democrats proposing something that is going to work for this nation as healthcare? Is Obamacare the right thing? Is the Affordable Care Act in line with what Obamacare wants? Is it right for this nation? And there's so many questions out there that so many people don't even know what to say. So many people don't even know how to answer. It's become so testing. It's become so lenient that nobody really knows what to do, what to sign up for, and if it's right, and if it'll cost too much, or if it'll even cover them at all. And so now moving on, the unemployment benefits deal, already DOA in House, hits Senate floor. The Senate begins debate Monday on a bill to exchange emergency unemployment benefits that looks headed for passage after months of disagreements over the cost and procedural matters that delayed a compromise between Democrats and Republicans. But 10 senators were finally able to come up with a bipartisan agreement earlier this month that will extend benefits for 5 more months and retroactively send checks to people whose benefits ran out when the program expired on December 28th. The measure got a strong bipartisan vote of 65-34 when lawmakers voted to proceed to debate last week, with 10 Republicans joining all 55 Democrats and independents. But even if the measure clears the Senate, it faces an uncertain future in the House. House Speaker John Boehner, the Republican from Ohio, has urged that the bill is not implementable. The letter he received from the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, which says the requirements of the Senate bill would cause delays in implementation, rack up increased administrative costs and challenges. The administration pushed back against the National Association of State Workforce Agencies' complaints with a letter from Labor Secretary Thomas Perez, contending that issuing retroactive benefits wouldn't be a problem. The Senate bill pays for the benefit extension by using a combination of spending reductions that include pension smoothing, a method that allows companies to use historic interest rate averages to calculate pension contributions, extending certain customs user fees, and allowing single employer pension plans to prepay their flat rate premiums to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Other offsets will draw on ideas from various lawmakers that should help guarantee support for the bill. It borrows a provision from Senators Tom Coburn, the Republican from Oklahoma, and John Tester, the Democrat from Montana, that ends unemployment insurance payments to any individual whose adjusted gross income in the preceding year was $1 million or more, as well as ideas from Senator Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine, to strengthen programs that will give more individualized aid to the long-term unemployed. Now, this debate, this deal has gone back and forth, obviously, in the House and in the Senate. And now that it's hit the Senate floor and looks like it could prosper through the Senate, it could hit the floor and just die in the House. as Boehner seems to not be in favor of this, and as Republicans seem to not be in favor of this, being that Boehner is a Republican and is the Speaker of the House, it all questions what can be done with a Republican as the Speaker of the House with this certain deal, with this certain bill. The unemployment benefits are so back and forth. They're so detailed. It's hard to really understand what they go through and how this deal gets written, devised, and how people really perceive what they're going to get as an unemployed individual in the United States. It's so back and forth that it's hard to really question what happens, because it's been so back and forth in the House, in Senate, in Congress. It's really hard to understand what really is going to happen with this deal if it passes the Senate and moves through the House. And now, on another note, we're moving on to some presidential race issues for 2016. As a GOP presidential race looms large as potential hopefuls gather, they would have you believe their trip has nothing to do with 2016, but it's easy to see why nobody's buying that. A gaggle of potential Republican presidential candidates, including Governors Chris Christie, the Republican from New Jersey, Scott Walker, the Republican from Wisconsin, and John Kasich, the Republican from Ohio, made the pilgrimage to Las Vegas Saturday to speak to a meeting of the Republican Jewish Coalition, a small but influential group of GOP luminaries. And in a happy coincidence, the ambitious governors just might cross paths with one of most prolific GOP donors in the country, a man whose financial support has almost single-handedly powered a major presidential campaign. That man, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, is hosting the RJC meeting this weekend at his Venetian resort on the Las Vegas Strip. During the 2012 primaries, $15 million of Adelson's money channeled through a super PAC was instrumental in launching Newt Gingrich to the force of the GOP race and sustaining his campaign long after his small dollar donations had dried up. Gingrich had a long friendship with Adelson dating back to his time as a Speaker of the House, but in 2016, Adelson's support is up for grabs, and the candidate who earns it will be poised to reap. Now, the potential candidates for the 2016 election for the GOP is so up in air. I mean, nobody really knows who's going to run, who's going to do what, but it is certain that there are some hopefuls here, as I mentioned, Chris Christie, Scott Walker, John Kasich. I mean, it's back and forth. Nobody, of course, it's 2016, so nobody's really putting forth yet, but there are some people that are looking to make a move and working on some things to put their name out there as a potential candidate. And speaking of the GOP and Republicans, they might actually have built-in advantages in the fight for the House. Even if Democrats recruit great candidates, raise gobs of money, and run smart campaigns, they face an uphill fight to retake control of the House in this year's congressional elections, regardless of the political climate in November. Why is this the reason? Or why is this the case? Because Republican strategists spent years developing a plan to take advantage of the 2010 census, first by winning state legislatures and then redrawing House districts to tilt the playing field in their favor. Their success was unprecedented. In states like Ohio, Michigan, and North Carolina, Republicans were able to shape congressional maps to pack as many Democratic voters as possible into the fewest House districts. The practice is called gerrymandering, and it left fertile ground elsewhere in each state to spread Republican voters among more districts, increasing the GOP's chances of winning more seats. Geography helped in some states. Democratic voters are more likely to live in densely populated urban areas, making it easier to pack them into fewer districts. The first payoff came in 2012 when Republicans kept control of the House despite a Democratic wave that swept President Barack Obama to a second term. The next payoff is likely to come this fall when candidates once again compete in House districts drawn by Republican legislators in key states. Gerrymandering has a long history in the United States, pursued enthusiastically by both Democrats and Republicans, but the GOP's success at it this decade has been historic. In 2012, Republicans maintained a 33-seat majority in the House, even though GOP candidates as a group got 1.4 million fewer votes than their Democratic opponents. Now, how does that happen? It's crazy how politics and how votes work like that. However, the Republicans do have a majority in the House since 2012. It's going to be hard to keep that, but it seems that they do have a little bit of an upper hand to have the advantage in the fight for the House. And now moving on to our last story here for national news. What is the Democrats' plan for keeping the Senate? The Senate Democrats this week laid out their legislative and political agenda for this year, making it clear they hope to replicate the electoral success they saw in 2012 by focusing on economic issues that impact the middle class. They expect their economic message should trump the Republicans' large focus on Obamacare. It's unclear whether Democrats will be able to sufficiently mobilize their 2012 supporters. The CBS News poll released this week shows that Republican voters are clearly more energized about this election. What's more, Senate Democrats this year are defending seats they won in 2008, a breakthrough year in which Democrats won 8 seats, the most they'd won since 1986. Now, it's back and forth of who will also keep the Senate, as in having the majority, having the upper hand in the Senate. There's been a lot of things going on, especially here in California, that could pose a threat to the Democrats, as the Republicans would be able to take over the House and the Senate and control Congress with John Boehner being the Speaker of the House. It is all back and forth. Obviously, nothing can be certain as the elections are coming up, but you can see here that the Democrats plan to reiterate their 2012 message and try to maintain the Senate majority and maintain the upper hand in the Senate, while it seems the Republicans will have the upper hand in the House. We are going to take one more quick short break here, and we will be right back with some California state political news, and then that will end our show for this week. Once again, you are listening to Penguin Radio on the one and only radio.dominican.edu, and you're here with DJ Liberty on my show, Political Row. Stay tuned.